from all this speculation, the panel itself. Transparency, very important, and moral hazards.
Oh, yeah.
That's almost a religious discussion, I guess. Speculation, of course, is never a present topic whenever a mark moves sharply. It's immediately offered to bang the speculator. He's the bad guy. Politicians and the media immediately find the scapegoat, and we know, however, that speculators are very rarely the real problem. Why the oxymoron? I believe our industry is failing in education. If our clients, media, politicians, yes, also the regulators, would be properly educated and knowledgeable of our products, a lot of misconceptions could be avoided. Transparency is key to any market. Actually, it's a reason to have a market, to guarantee a fair price and access to all. But as so often, it's something easier said than done. Lack of transparency breeds profits for those reaping them, and they often hate to give those up. Then we have the moral hazards. There are plenty of them out there, not only for derivatives. Commodity speculation may be one of them. But investment banks gambling with their clients' money, IT failures, politicians setting rules they do not understand themselves, bureaucratic regulators implementing the stupid laws, lack of proper judicial framework, just to name a few, are much bigger moral hazards. I like to always look a bit deeper into where the problems come from. Let me make an attempt also here. Obviously, speculation is ingrained in the human spirit. It's human nature. Remember the tulip crisis, South Seas bubble, subprime crisis, to name a very few. In all places, it was clear to everyone, you rise a bubble, and everybody hopes you get out in time. But most failed. History repeats itself, and most got caught. The current problem really started in Bretton Woods. Well thought out program predicts stability, but it failed because of some beautiful theory. It worked for a few years, but ended in fantastic disaster as there were no remedies in place to fix it when it started to fall apart. When Nixon abolished it, a can of worms opened. The financial markets embraced the concept of exchange-traded derivatives as they were successful in commodities and options were legalized. Yes, don't forget, until 1974, options were illegal in the US. Until 1980, they were illegal in commodities. So it's a new dream. Market forces, unfortunately, didn't always do a good job. Often greed took over. A little more efficient, self-reasonable self-regulation would have gone a long way. But the financial markets failed, so politicians got invited into the game, and they often tried to fix what was already broken, since they did not understand the issues. Ever since, they tried to contain the escaping worms, but had no success. To the contrary. As facing the SOX had worked, you wouldn't have had the crisis of 2007-8. Now we are blessed with Dodd-Frank. He cannot turn the wheel back, however, and have to live with it and find a way out of the mess created. The important thing to me at this conference is to highlight some of the failings or to point out some of the potential cures in order to assist the emerging markets in setting up their markets properly and to avoid the mistakes made by the so-called big boys. We will try to identify some of the important points to watch for an exchange in order, or marketplace, in order not to be hit by the moral hazard stroke. Before we start, let me introduce my distinguished panel. In alphabetical order, to be very fair. We have Vijay Kumar, who is the Chief Business Officer at NCDX in India. He has a strong background not only in commodities trading, both physical and derivatives, but also on the factory side, namely technology and process management. And we have Lucas Law, Division Head, Jakarta Futures Exchange. He started out designing and changed systems for JFX, then branched out into new business streams, including commodity trading. Today he is, among many other duties, involved in the development of a new clearing venture. Hassan Mahmood is the head of research, product development and risk at the Pakistan Mercantile Exchange. He has also been involved in the development and marketing of various products listed on PMEX, who is trading both financial products as well as commodities. Last but not least, Chris Sturgis, our outgoing chairman, is director at the China Spot Stock Exchange and chairman of outgoing chairman BFM Packages. Chris is the head of the commodities market of JSE, and next to Rod Gravel of London, one of the major driving forces behind the successful commodity derivatives in South Africa. I'm Paul Meyer, happily retired after a very long career in commodities with Walker Brothers in Winterthur, a large trading house for cotton, and then in derivatives with journalist AFM. For quite some time, I was also active with Swiss Futures Options Association and AFM, which to this day remains very close to my heart, as I believe it's a very important link between new and old experience, those eager to learn. Our panel shall be a discussion, not a succession of presentations. So I ask all panelists to freely discuss the issues tabled by the others. This also goes for you. If you would like to add your opinion or ask a question, please feel free to raise your hand and participate. So much from me. I hope the rest is from the panel. I would like to start discussion with a very short round on moral hazards. What are the main moral hazards in your opinion facing both your exchanges or our industry in general? Let's start with
thank you, Paul. In terms of moral hazards, I believe that our exchange, even any exchange. In terms of moral hazards, I think the moral hazards that exchanges face is when they focus more on creating the volumes. That creates a problem for the market. Their focus should be the price discovery, their focus should be the transparency, and to facilitate the whole ecosystem of the commodity, to facilitate the whole market chain. But some exchanges, or somehow, the exchanges are for profit. When they start looking at the volumes, to generate volumes, to make profit, then it becomes a moral hazard. But actually, when we face our market, we see, I believe, that the moral hazards are there in the spot of the cash market, other than on the exchanges. Exchanges somehow are more transparent. In terms of transparency, they are more transparent as compared to the spot market. Our market, especially, we face creating liquidity on our exchange, a lot of problems for agri products, mainly because of the non-transparency in the spot market. The spot market players don't want to bring their volume on the exchange, because they believe if they trade on the exchange, they will become transparent, and it might create problems for them, or they might, or their hegemony will reduce. This is why they don't come on the transparent exchange. So I believe the moral hazards are more relevant to the spot markets rather than to the exchanges.
But just to jump in here, you want to say, this applies to all players or just the big players that are like it? Because I'm not able to assume.
Yes, it's more relevant to the big players. Generally in Pakistan, every commodity is controlled by a few big players. In most of the cases, the big players are not more than 10. So that few big players don't want to make the markets transparent, and somehow they also control the political arena of the country.
Okay. Vijay?
Yeah, I think as an organization, an exchange is considered to be an embodiment of trust because That's all actually that you you're offering, and the technology platform is just a means to provide that trust to the marketplace. So I think one of it's, and therefore it's very important to be, not only to be fair, but to be seen to be fair. And I think the market, in a market where money is made and lost, there's a tendency on the part of participants to credit themselves and their intelligence when they win, and to blame someone else when they lose. And so one of the things that we've seen is the degree of heat or anger is very strong when there's a lot of money that's lost. And as you mentioned, it's attributed to speculation and attributed to manipulation, some of which may be true, but a lot of it causing strong pain. And that then, you need to get the message across that this is your own doing, because the market is fair. How do you do it? How do you ensure that the market realizes that it is their actions that have caused the loss and not an external manipulation is critical, in my opinion. And the earlier that gets done, the easier it is to build up a platform like industry.
How can you build up that trust?
Yeah, I think, I mean, it's also important for the participants. I think the one of the analogies that was recently given by someone from industry finance was that if you create, for example, an institution like the traffic light system, right, you also have to have participants who observe those rules. So you, in India, very few people, for example, switch on their indicators. So you wonder why the automobile manufacturers are mandated to have a right indicator and a left indicator if you can turn right or left without pressing the indicator. So I think there's a, and it is very difficult once it becomes a habit for you to manage traffic at all. When the traffic lights don't mean anything, fines are a form of extortion or corruption and so on. So I think it's very important very early on that rules are uniformly applied, that penalties are swiftly in place, and conduct that's unbecoming of a fair marketplace is quickly addressed. So sometimes we are viewed as a very tough market or almost an arrogant market, but I think it is necessary, because without that it again quickly gets out of hand.
So a business contact committee makes sense?
Well, absolutely.
Chris?
Thank you, Paul. I guess on the subject of morals, first of all, everyone sitting in the room with the morally correct thing coming here to listen to us after lunch, so well done. You've got some morals. I think if you come back to the exchange space and you always think of, you know, what is the component that drives so many people, it's greed. And I think it's what is your level of greed is going to influence on how you participate in the market, and when is enough in the sense of profits. And I think tying back into what Vijay indicated is really, as the exchange operators, we need to ensure we have a framework of rules and regulations that kind of keeps morals intact. Yes, there's going to be people, there's going to be participants who want to test those from time to time. But as long as the exchange is in a position to be consistent in how it applies the mandate of operating the exchange, we as exchange operators take on a lot of responsibility. But to also be fair, I think we need to recognize that the exchange operator, we're not perfect. We're also making mistakes. We're also learning as we're evolving and developing our own markets. And as long as, I guess it comes back to you're doing the right thing. But yeah, often I think even on morals there's a fine line. And hopefully as an exchange operator you're not trying to aim to sail along a very fine line, and you're always just on the very far left or right depending on where you want to go. But you're doing the right thing.
Greed is obviously, like I said, it's human nature, and I guess that's also very often for regulators to struggle. Greed is very often at the center of the problems, but you cannot regulate greed. Lucas?
Yes, I think greed is important, yeah. I mean, in the sense that in a capitalist world like this, greed is what drives the progress, right? So we cannot blame greed, I think, yes. In our market, in the Indonesian market, we have it's embarrassing here in Indonesia. The moral hazard that we face here is revolves around the use of customers' money for brokers' own internal use. And sometimes they run away with the customers' money. That is clearly a moral hazard for me. Yes.
So we have no segregation rules here? You have no segregation rules here?
Yes, we have.
So you have the same problem as in the US, they have segregation rules, but they're on the way to come on your own. So, it's one of those things where you have rules, but it's hard to... Okay.
On the segregation, of course, I would like to add something. Because when he mentioned it, Pakistan working on exchange was establishing, we were framing the rules and regulations. We had a very bad history of the stock exchange where it was very common to use the client's money by the brokers, their own prop book. So from the day one, we made compulsory that whenever a broker receives money, he has to pass on to the exchange, and the exchange maintains the ledger of each and every client. So every client can view his ledger balances, his positions on the exchange terminal rather than on the terminal of the broker or a piece of paper on the broker. So from that angle, we are very transparent and realizing this, the fact that this is a moral hazard and the broker can use one client's money for another client or even for his own proprietary trading. From the day one, we segregated the clients of broker, segregated the clients of all clients.
Let's just say, because I think there's a very interesting aspect, a very important one also. I mean, we could see in the Better IMF Global and all that in the US, that covered a lot in the papers. So how do you do it in India?
I think we've not had serious problems on client money. In fact, even on the IMF Global case, in India, IMF Global continued to run, though it shut down almost everywhere else in the world, partly because there were capital controls, so money just could be moved in and out every day. If a foreign broker needs to move out money, there are a lot of processes he has to fulfill. So MF Global, until their recent acquisition by Philip Futures, continued to operate. So we've not had that issue. But I think it's certainly critical, and there are ways in which maybe we need to change regulations to allow for those monies to be kept in separate bank accounts and balances to be reported every day rather than maybe once every quarter. Today, the regulations force excess money to be returned to clients every quarter, at least so that the clients have a feel that they're getting the money back and they can choose whether to put it back or not.
But we do not have kind of segregation at this moment.
Brokers are required to segregate it.
Yeah,
but the exchange doesn't hold those companies.
But segregated at the broker.
Yeah, the South African model definitely. There's very clear rules around segregating funds. We also have the ability at the exchange level to set positions down to client level. So we can go all the way to the lowest possible level. But if we chat about MF Global, yes, MF Global was the rest of the clients on the exchange. But when things went south for them, all of a sudden we had clients phoning us out of the US we had no idea about. And that's what we get, I guess, when a player does start to operate these type of accounts, you need to be very clear when you're signing up. Am I recognized by the exchange? Do I have a dedicated client account? And that's also part of our education campaign is, yes, there's always, the challenge for us is everyone says, oh, well, I'm a registered broker on the exchange. But have you really done the check? And therefore, we try to encourage many of those clients, visit our website, give us a call, double check that you are registered and protected by the rules of the exchange. But every now and then, you find someone falling victim to a broker who said, I'm registered, you can give me your physical commodity, and the player then just disappears with money.
Would you say there would be a possibility to, like in Pakistan, say all those accounts have to move to the exchange? Or would that help in the end?
I think, again, if you look at the exchange structure, trading through exchange is very, very secure. Because we hold, the funds are held by the carrying members, which are all licensed banks. So they are then regulated in that sense. I think where the challenge lies is the over-the-counter market. We're never going to regulate that. So it's education and making sure the client is aware of what are the benefits of trading on exchange versus taking on the counterparty risk over the counter. And that is, when you get offered a deal that's just simply too good to be true, I think it comes back to your morals. You think, okay, if anyone's tried to exchange some rupiah here, you can see there's many different rates advertised. And if you walk into somewhere, 12,000 plus, to the US dollar, I know there's something, and it's fun. You walk in there and you say, sir, what's your rate? And you start counting out money, and just as he's about to give the last, okay, hang on, there's 15% commission I didn't tell you about. And so again, it comes back when the numbers are too good to be true, you have to ask the questions.
There's no question on that. I'm sure we're going to get back to one or the other aspect, but let's maybe go for a quick second round on the main theme of the panel there is speculation. And Richard made a very interesting mark in our preparatory emails where he wrote, speculators do serve a role apart from hedges in providing liquidity, and yet may disrupt markets. Where must we draw the line? Speculative losses moved from billions in the case of Barings to billions in the case of Lehman. There's a lot to watch out for in our future. Interesting, if not even frightening prospects. Maybe you would like to expand a little bit?
Yeah, I think, when the exchanges were first brought in, they were with a certain economic purpose. And in India, we've had this long tradition of futures, but no futures exchange. So they operated in an informal market, which was obviously dangerous. But once you create formal exchanges, then you know that there is, as Lucas mentioned, re-driving a lot of the interest in trading and leveraged trading attacks. So there is a lot of money and emotion behind making more and more money. All of which is fine as long as markets remain in a zone. But once markets take off, there are a lot of gainers and a lot of losers, and you can begin to see the effects of that damage from a loser's point of view, and then the media getting into it, and then all the allegations of speculation, etc., coming in. And unfortunately, I think it all centers around that this exchange somehow is the reason for this to happen. And I think we've been a victim to a couple of negative actions from the government side in terms of, say, banning futures on a few contracts, not permitting relisting of those contracts until prices have sort of come back to a certain level. But I think now the regulator and the bureaucracies are a lot more conversant with the role of futures. So we have, for instance, many products in which are not traded on exchanges where the prices have moved from 4 rupees to 70 rupees. Okay, some of the perishable vegetables, for instance. And so the government's realizing that speculation can occur in any field, and it's not just on the exchange. In fact, the exchange is a far safer place, as Chris pointed out, because it is position limits are in place, circuit limits are in place, mark-to-market is being paid out, and so on. So I think that education process is critical before you run into large speculation causing large profits. I think that's something to take care of while building exchanges. It can be very hurtful to the market if speculation results in actions against the market itself. So that's one point that we've at least seen, and maybe been wiser for.
How do you look at the speculative issue?
I personally feel the speculator is generally is considered bad outside the exchange. But the speculator is actually the facilitator who facilitates the whole market. If everyone comes as a hedger or everyone is on one side, it is the speculator who takes the other side of the trade. But I think in case of you refer just the Baring and Lehman Brothers case, in that case the speculation was not an issue. The issue was internal control and procedures and SOPs of that institutions. In case of Baring's, only one man doing it, a certain decision led to that big crisis. So it's actually the too much authority to that person and that led to that crisis. So the institutions should focus more on the SOPs and internal controls and procedures. If an institution have internal good internal control and procedures and do not divest too much authority to a single person, then I think speculation will not hurt them at all. And even rightly, Vijay said, in case of Pakistan, there is too much speculation in spot market other than on the exchange. In a few days, I have known that before listing sugar on our exchange, the people were very reluctant to list the sugar on the exchange because they have a very bad history that in a few months the sugar prices rose from rupees 50 to rupees 100. There was some inherent issues at that time and that led to increase in the prices. But government and the regulatory agencies were reluctant to list the sugar on the exchange because of the fear of that speculation. But after listing on the exchange, there is no crisis, everything is working smoothly.
I think just on the point of speculators, risk takers, critical. I'm not going to argue that point to any marketplace. But I guess when starting out as an exchange, sometimes you just wish you had instant access to speculators. Why? Because you're looking for liquidity. But it's a confidence-building exercise where you start out. You have to have the right design in place, which means you need to get the fundamentals right in terms of bringing hedges together. Once you've got your hedges in place and there's liquidity, then the speculators will follow. So I guess the approach in South Africa was we focused a lot of our time and energy building the hedger player. And I guess in the commodity space, particularly in the agricultural space, farmers are natural speculators anyway, and what we found, they would open up two accounts, one for speculating, one for hedging. So at least in their mind and in their daily statements, they had a good idea. This is money I can lose, and this is for my hedge positions. But I think coming back as an exchange operator, it's our responsibility to make sure in our design that it is robust enough that we're not open to market abuse. And I know later on we might touch on again physical delivery. And if we have commodities that go into delivery, make sure the settlement cycle is robust and is limited to market abuse. It's going to be tested. But speculators are good. They provide space. An experience in South Africa, we had seen significant growth and we had no position limits in place for any speculators. And unfortunately we had a nasty experience with a pension fund who came in and decided, look, I will potentially drive this market, and they really became dominant position holders on a speculative side. And unfortunately, yes, it did cause damage to the marketplace, but for us it was a very important learning curve to be able to say we now respond to position limits and we'll move on from there.
Yeah, just one thing I'd like to add to what Chris has said. In fact, in some of the markets that we are addressing, for example in sugar, I'm now talking to an audience which seems to feel that there is speculation on the futures exchange by pointing out the facts. And the facts, for example, in this case are that in India today there'll be 15 million tons of sugar with sugar plants already crushed in their warehouses, right? The open interest on the exchange is less than 100,000 tons. So I asked the question, so where is speculation occurring? Is it occurring on the exchange with 100,000 tons of OI or 15 million tons of OI that's sitting in exchange, that's sitting in sugar factories, which is not hedged? So in fact, the point, we are flipping the question over to say that why are you allowing speculation by sugar factories, which are essentially in a commodity business? And we're saying if it was their own capital, that's fine. Most of them are running huge loans from banks, and now we are educating banks on this issue that when you lend to a commodity firm or a firm which is in the business largely on a commoditized product, insist on a hedge. And if there was a mandated hedging, we'll be having a 5 million ton open interest at least, and that's reflected on, some of it may be reflected on global exchange, but most of it is just not hedged. And the way it seems to be working over a cycle is that the industry says, I'll just play this game on the bank's money. If I make money, I'll reward myself. If I lose money, I might shut down. Or I will, as in India, what's happening today is the farmers are not being paid for 6 months on the sugarcane purchases. So I think in a lot of ways, we are addressing the question by pointing out where speculation is occurring and that the exchange is actually a place for hedging that speculation. And of course, for liquidity, some speculation is also valued on the exchange.
So that was basically what we had this morning on education, media, know-how is power, and that message should somehow be able to go out.
Well, absolutely, yeah. And I think it's happening, and this, I'm very sure media plays a very important role. I think it's how you construct the story, how you bring it to the notice of the banks, the institutions, including the ministry, to say that the purpose of installing exchanges is to add economic value, and therefore the first step is to move into that zone of credibility, which is very difficult because the attacks begin almost as soon as you create an exchange. But once you're able to do that, I think then the questions are asked about why participants are not hedging rather than why the exchange is encouraging speculation.
I'd like to add on this. Speculation is good. I mean, speculation itself is not problem as of right? Speculation on someone else's money without their consent probably is as of that. So I would like, in our case actually, we want to see more and more speculation until the point that speculation is given too much that we want to have that problem actually to happen on our exchange. Yeah. So in Barry's case, I mean, the moral hazard that we recently did was that he covered up the losses, right, to that. So in Lehman's case, I don't think there was a moral hazard there because it's just too much speculation, too much bad. If the bet was right and everybody was happy, there was no moral hazard there, I think.
I disagree on Lehman not being a moral hazard. I mean, if I look at Dodd-Frank, I mean, he had a huge moral hazard. right? Dodd Frank is the answer to Lehman Brothers, so obviously it was considered to be a huge moral problem.
Clients put their money in Lehman's, the clients put their money there in their concept bank. So if the bank was right and everybody was happy, there was no more.
So in that case, we must say that politicians are at fault to come up with the solution.
Yeah.
I think one thing is, on what are you speculating? It's critical for two reasons. One is, with mortgage-backed security, you can keep creating structures that encourage speculation and enable speculation. And it's got to be for a cause. I mean, a casino is a known place for speculation to occur, where you go in knowing that I'm going to lose this money, and you walk out pretty happy because you're upfront knowing what it is, and it's a zero-sum game there. I don't think the world of the real economy is meant to be a gambling den. It's meant to be allocation of capital for the right resources. So excessive speculation on assets which you don't know who's securitizing them, who's borrowing that money. I think there is a moral hazard there. Even on commodities, in some commodities, for instance, just because you have the money doesn't mean you can buy all the water and hold it with you. That's not the purpose of an exchange. So we have commodities, for instance, which are narrow, where maybe you have 1 million tons, or even in some cases like pepper, 50,000 tons. You could bring in serious money and just take off on that. Now, is it justifiable to prevent that product from being consumed just because you have the money to buy it and destroy it or destroy yourself? I think therein lies some degree of balance as to what is the purpose and who's allowed to speculate, what's the purpose of speculation.
But there's a position limit, I think, in the exchange rate.
Yeah, there are position limits, and that's the point. One of the things is speculation at a physical layer. So you're right. In fact, to that extent, the futures is a better place to speculate because everyone's equal, position limits are specified, and so on. But I'm just saying, in the general context of speculation being a good thing, sometimes it's too much of it and can be a bad thing.
Let's just stay on that subject of position limits because the CFTC is having a discussion on this now and all that, so I think it's interesting to see how your exchanges are handling that. Maybe the CFTC can learn from you on your success stories.
Yeah,
position limits?
Yes, we do have position limits, and only hedgers get exemption based on their actual track record of participating on the asset size, processing, import, export, actual track record. We grant them exemption limits. One of the, there are obviously participants who try to collude, so they get 50 other people to take positions on their behalf. And so you don't know because these are all individual clients. But we've gone to the extent where there is a serious move up to even refer it to the finance ministry and get banking transactions which show that funds have moved from one entity to 50 others and then positions have been taken, so that you're deemed to be acting in concert. So I think the regulators have given exchanges the flexibility now to take action wherever they suspect some abusive activity of that sort.
So I think it's also in the quality space to have position limits in place for speculators, and that way there's limited quality. Similar to what Peter mentioned, there's an overall limit for all participants, particularly when you're going into equilibrium. We obviously have a much more relaxed approach for filler out and expire months, but you want to make sure when you're going into the physical equilibrium month, it's really just three edges in there.
So you have a variation of position limits, and I guess you adjusted on the price movements and on the opening the story. Is that more or less a big limit?
It's a limit that's adjusted based on the underlying commodity that we focus on. So in our soybean markets, we're about 1 million tons, and then we'll have a number fixed on that. We started out back in 2001 only producing 200,000 tons. So as production's increased, so we just amended the limits. We tend to not change the that frequently. So you're adjusting maybe once a year on that side. But I think, again, it's just building the exchange. You need to be mindful of what is that product. How do you keep the environment honest when you're going into the delivery cycle?
You have position limits, Chairman?
Yeah, luckily, I mean, unfortunately, there's been cases that we have to enforce that rule, because current position holdings are still low compared to the mainstream.
At our exchange, the international credit commodities like gold, silver, and crude oil, we have very generous position limits from our regulators. And with reference to the agri products, the volumes at the exchange are quite low, so we have not reached at that there the market participants feel that position limits are low. So we do have position limits, and still the position limits are quite. Market participants are quite okay with that position. I just want to add something with the discussion of speculation. Actually, there is a fine line between the gambling and the speculation. Actually, the problem starts when we miss out that fine line. When a speculator becomes a gambler, then the problem starts.
I agree. I mean, we have in Switzerland, they have dispute in Switzerland, can have a referendum on anything. It just went on mass immigration, and 3 months we're going to vote about buying a jet. I mean, you can vote on anything. If there is a party that launched an initiative against speculation in commodities, because there's so many poor people out there going hungry because of the bad speculators. So I was with them, had a discussion, and I said, look, what is speculation? And then they sort of said, well, yeah, okay, we'll have to find a definition for this. I said, okay, I have a problem. Now, I gave them the case, well, we had this beautiful presentation in South Africa, in Johannesburg last year, where a farmer came and he talked to us about using the futures markets. And I remember he said, look, I know this talk about speculation, but please make sure you don't take that away. Because there's no speculator out there anymore, you force me to be a speculator. I'm going to be able to hedge. Don't force me to be a speculator. So I told them to those guys and said, yeah, but you know, in the end it comes a bit down to this, you know, is it gambling or is it taking risk? But I told them, forget it, because you're not going to be able to legislate for the speculation. But they go ahead and collect the signatures, and I guess in a year or so we spoke about the speculation commodities, which we have nothing to do with the not, but that's Switzerland. But let's just quickly speak on this subject of position limits. I mean, to enforce position limits, you have to know the positions. So, do you have daily reportings by your members? And if so, do you produce a weekly report, say like the commitment of traders report, or is that, or how do you handle that?
Yeah, let me start off. Because we keep the positions down to client level, for us it's very easy to understand the position, and we can obviously, if the client has multiple accounts with multiple brokers, we see all of that, we can add it up. And therefore, you know, even if you bring in their option portfolio or their futures portfolio, we know exactly what the net exposure is. So within our market regulation team, they're watching those very, very carefully. In terms of commitment of trader reporting, it's something that we've discussed extensively over the last year with our market participants. And where we brought in the regulator, and I guess in the South African environment, we have one regulator for all license, for the exchange and various products. And really, we have a good relationship and a partnership with the regulator and really work together on all of these type of policy issues. And in terms of commitment of traders reporting, at the end of the day, we decided, yes, we support the principle of being able to publish the position. How the
dilemma was, because there's, at the end of the day, a limited amount of market participants that have a sizable position, where if you sit with two, maybe three players on one side of the market, and you start to just publish now position limit or the potential position, you actually start to compromise those two, three players. And therefore, we said, we fully committed, we set the framework, if we will start to publish commitment for traders type reporting as soon as we get to having a minimum of 15 players who have more than 10,000 tons. Once we get to that level, either on the hedger side and speculator side, we will then start to go that route. But until such time, we're going to then keep that just at exchange level.
But it basically goes into the title of the panel, that transparency is one part of it. In a way, that will be giving transparency to everyone to show. And I personally feel that the Committee of Trade Support, as well as CFTC, is very helpful. Also to the speculator. I mean, if you want to track the speculator, I think it's good too for him to see who is in the market. And Mr. Lim is the head of the CFTC. It's a very, you can draw some very interesting conclusions.
Fully support transparency argument. But the dilemma we're sitting is you're starting to compromise a position, a client, who, if let's play the other side, let's say there were only three hedgers who had live positions, and I knew what my position was, and it's been published by the exchange, I could quickly work out what my competitors are doing and start to create a position from there. So that's why we thought, let's just look for some critical mass, look for some numbers, and then we'll fully support the transparency side.
That makes sense. Of course, you could also set the limit pretty low on what is the small speculator who then lost immediately have more players in your group. So
also, another number that we threw around, and we thought, look, 10,000 tons when you've got an underlying commodity of 12 million tons. Come on, that's, no one can really get any smaller than that.
You have a comment. How do you control the position limits, and do you have a report showing the breakdown?
Yeah, we have what we call position limits, and we have what we call reporting limits. Yeah. So when a client has positions above that reporting limit, they have to, actually the broker has to report to us every day. Until that position decreases beyond that, below that reporting limit. On the commitment of traders, we have two exchanges here in Indonesia, so and we basically also trade the same contracts. So one exchange position, I mean, commitment of traders cannot be produced by just one exchange.
In our case, we generally do not report the position limits outside the exchange. We monitor the art positions to the client level. We have a system given the client is working on three different brokers. We just club them and monitor to the client level. But we do not report because in case of a CME, it makes sense to report the position limits. But for smaller exchanges like us, it is actually, it goes against the transparency, because the other clients, the other people know what Mr. A is doing, what Mr. B is doing, that has more interest of the market. So we, at the current level, we do not report the position numbers outside the exchange, but we do monitor at the exchange level.
Yeah, actually it's quite similar for us. One of the reasons for that is though we classify hedgers, we don't have small spec and large spec, partly because the large spec are not allowed to participate. There is no bank, mutual fund, hedge fund permitted to participate in the commodities market. And so one of the things that we are trying to do is to first encourage more people to use the hedger more. So if you're registered as a hedger, you are given a specific code, so all trades have to be entered in that code. And if you're a speculator, then you're subject to the normal limits. Now, one of the things is that when speculation is deemed to have gone beyond a certain level, the regulator, apart from initial margins, applies, or based on VAR-based margins, applies what are called additional and special margins. And those sometimes are fairly high if the regulator believes that this is getting a bit too hot. And so one of the things we're suggesting to the regulator is that you exempt hedgers from such margins. If you feel speculators are driving up the market, the hedgers have no reason to benefit from it because they are holding a physical position against their short. So that once we get to encouraging more hedgers to use the hedge short, then maybe we will have enough number of hedgers and enough positions put up together that individual positions won't be compromised. So we are just waiting for that.
Perhaps you might just ask BJ a question, because this was part of our challenge, was defining the hedger versus the speculator. So if you've got this code that says I'm a hedger, who's actually policing that and making sure is it really a true hedger? Because I guess in our environment, again, because you're trying to be initial margin efficient, most people try and run one consolidated account.
So we police the hedging very carefully. So first of all, because the hedge limits are fairly high. So for example, in the sort of example gives, the 20,000 tons is the position, is the spec position limit which anyone is allowed to access. The hedger may actually be holding a 200,000 ton position. And therefore, that limit is accorded to him based on his capacity, exposure, and so on. And at no point in time is he allowed to have that position without the physical exposure. So the moment he offloads his physical exposure, he must cut down his position. And we've had some cases where the hedger had this large position and decided, for example, to get in the morning and reduce positions by 20,000-30,000 tons, and in the afternoon again by 20,000-30,000, just joining that large position. And even that, the exchange clamped down on, saying that the purpose of a hedge court or a hedge position is to stay hedged, not to come in and out of the market in large volumes. So we do believe that. Not on a daily basis, but once in a couple of months we will audit and then make sure that the hedger is actually using the tool for hedging and not for taking large spec positions.
Just so I'm clear then, it's only once you get to that limit, above the limit, you really then do it.
Correct, correct.
Questions from the crowd or comments? Christian?
Just got a microphone.
Okay.
Exchange in Malawi. I was so impressed that the previous panel and Rod introduced himself with multiple backgrounds. So I also have multiple backgrounds. The previous one, I was a lawyer, and that's my excuse for not understanding this speculation. What I do know is the exchange that we are trying to put in place, we need the speculators to give the liquidity, and the reason is we want to balance out the price volatility. We want to create a fair price for the farmer and price stability. At the moment, we have really low prices after harvest and really high prices in the lean season. So that's the process we are just starting in Malawi now. There will come a time when we actually have leveled this price differential out. And I assume that this is not good for the speculators because there's no incentive for him to be in the market anymore. So my question is this what has happened to the more evolved exchanges, that you reach despite a price stable environment that benefits your farmer, but now for the exchange to really continue growing, you actually have to create some volatility in the market to bring speculators back? And is this what happens when in futures you allow people to sell something they don't have? I mean, if I was Chris's dad, a potato farmer in South Africa, I would be pretty annoyed if somebody came into my market and sold potatoes I don't have, and therefore reducing the price. And Is this really the moral hazard of the exchange? This intrinsic contradiction that I assume what you're trying to do with limit positions, creating these rules for hedging, is actually you're trying to manage this. You're trying to manage the volatility your exchange will allow. So you just keep the speculators interested and attached to your exchange. So I guess if I'm making myself any sense at all, is this a necessary evil that we do need to actually keep the price stability in the longer run?
Let me stop. That's for the well-structured lawyer question from the question. So that's why the media is so key to the exchange. We feed them with propaganda so that we can get huge amount of volatility. I'm joking, guys. That's just a joke. Jonas, we got that off the record. So I think it comes back to, as exchange operators, we are not going to be, it will be morally incorrect for us to be able to feed volatility into the marketplace. Remember, if there's not market movement in the price, there's no need to manage price risk. With us, why we introduce derivative contracts is to be able to provide a platform for the potato farmer or for any user of the product to be able to manage their price risk component. So, where we bring in position limits and try to manage the role of the speculator is really just to make sure that the environment that we operate in is fair and is limited to abuse. There are always going to be players who want to test the system. There's always going to be someone who, from a greed component, is going to try and dominate the market. And really, it's just these are the rules that enables fair trade or fair play, if you want to think it from that point of view. You would also notice that if you take the Malawi situation, your borders are not as fluid. And what I mean by that is, you're surrounded by land, your neighbor is landlocked, but you also sometimes have export bans, which does make in another market where you can move product in and out. Farmers, everyone in the market, soon realizes we're connected to the global market. You cannot just, that commodity price is not just the local market price. And again, so prices will go up, they will come down. Obviously, as an exchange operator, we want to see volatility. Why? Because that means someone needs to manage price risk. But we will not, this is the important boundary, is we cannot overstep that and send out signals that is going to cause more chaos to the marketplace. So let me give you an example. At the moment in South Africa, we have very, very tight stock levels for our staple food, our white maize crop. So white maize certainly consumed in the region. And what happened earlier in the season, a lot of our traders exported our surplus before we had a surplus of maize to Mexico and a couple of other destinations. So what we've got at the moment is everyone very panicking to say, will we have enough stock to get us through until the new season crop comes in? Again, the exchange is managing positions. We understand, and we are monitoring carefully every player who has an obligation to make delivery. We are very strict on position limits, but we are not going out there saying, guys, we have a huge crisis on our hands. There is going to be pandemonium. We are going to be short placed. That is not the role of the exchange. That is the function of willing buyer, willing seller, trading in the market. Our role is to make sure the rules are clear and no one is breaking the rules. And when I say those rules are very specific to the position limits for the marketplace. I think I've said that.
I think the 2 points to your specific issue, and we've seen that in India in terms of the early stages of the futures exchange, that the primary problem is that farmers, that the prices at harvest are very low and the prices at the end of the season too high. And it is true that as more and more, not necessarily speculators, we call them on the category called cash and carry operators, who buy the physical commodity and sell it 6 months down the line and earn that interest or the return beyond the interest cost and storage and insurance cost that they have. And so early, if you look at our historical pricing, people were earning 30%, 35% an annum on just a return on just holding stocks. And today it's down to maybe 20% in some, 15% in some, and barely covering cost of capital in a lot of other cases. Having said that, I think there's still room for speculators to play a role. So the cash and carry operators will switch to crops which are in surplus, where there is a need for people to store. But I think there's a lot of room for speculators to define what's going to happen, not today, but what's going to happen 6 months down the line. And that's a powerful pricing signal for farmers to decide whether to plant or not. So one of the tragedies of agricultural economy is that farmers are playing the most risky game there is. I mean, he's got a small amount of land, he has to decide what to plant. Once he plants it, and the tendency is to go by historical prices and plant something, and then prices just plummet. So, and we've seen this in vegetables and in crops, even in these fancy crops like vanilla, when oil prices go off, suddenly this, everyone and his mother's sort of planting that crop. And so where speculators play a role is to identify, get aggregate market information and correct pricing, even as planting intentions are being known, so that farmers can correct their decision before it's too late. Once they plant this huge crop, they are not going to get the right prices. Or for farmers to be very educated, and if they are then planting such a large crop, then at least to hedge some part of it themselves by selling and sort of capturing some of those distant prices rather than waiting for the whole crop to come and then realizing that's just a mirage. So
maybe just to also again emphasize the obvious, that the speculator only enters the marketplace when there's enough liquidity, when there's an opportunity to unwind the position. Because there's no point climbing into a position thinking I'm going to make a huge amount of money if I can't actually exit the position. So therefore, you know, as you build the market, is a function of you need enough liquidity so that there's an opportunity that you can easily move in and out of that marketplace, that position.
Why don't you pick up the second question Christian had, banning short selling? Do you think it's a good idea? Or I think it's... I'm obviously very much against it, but let's hear your opinion there, because it's something that keeps coming up every time the market goes down. It's best back with the short selling.
I think short selling is very important for the market. Without short selling, you cannot limit the prices, because if you it's the short seller that is providing a check on the rising prices. So short selling is a very important feature of the futures exchanges. Without that, the beauty of the whole system will collapse. So short selling is an important feature that should remain there.
What I always say to people who are buying short sellers, that don't forget one thing. Every short seller is a buyer. And usually most rallies, most market collapses are saved by the short sellers when they cover their shorts. And if the market goes up, shorts are the best buyers. Why do you have some of the rallies? It's a short cover.
The trick is the farmer just needs to know when the short seller needs to buy, then he's good.
Well, the more short sellers in the market, he just has to keep the position. Lucas, anything on the short selling or the speculator? Any other questions? Of course, otherwise I would just quickly go on to an important thing. You always talk about liquidity, so market making. Obviously, key for the success of any market, to get liquidity, to get not only the hedger, but also the speculator, to get the market going and moving. What do you suggest to the people here, what should they undertake as a market to stimulate market making? Or, another question maybe, can you really do much?
very important function, I think, especially for the new exchanges. We are relatively a new entrant in the commodity business. Our exchange is established in 2007. But we could not succeed in bringing liquidity in most of the products, even in the gold, the most credible item at the spot markets and the OTC market. Because whenever we approach to the market participants, to the jewelers, to trade or to hedge jewelry positions on the exchange, their excuse was because they don't want to trade or they don't want to make the market. They just trade at a place where the entry and exit is very easy, and at that desired level where they want to make an entry in the exchange and where they want to make an exit. So the market participants actually want a place where the easy entry and easy exit is possible. The market makers actually provide that function. They give sort of a guarantee to every participant that you can enter at your desired level and you can make an exit at your desired level. So market making is really an important function. In our case, we started operation in 2007, but actually our growth started in 2009 when we succeeded in bringing the local market participants at the exchange. Since then, the volumes are growing very rapidly, and currently it's around $4 billion, or 4 billion rupees of volume per day at the exchange. But the volume in the OTC market is huge, still huge, because of that function the OTC market provides that we are still lacking. Because the big players in the market, they still think that the exchange, the makers of the exchange have a limited capacity, they have some inherent weaknesses, they could not provide that kind of a guaranteed entry and exit to the big players. So I think we were initially discussing the market making should be an international feature. The market players, international market makers of international level should be allowed to perform the market making function at the exchanges, especially the exchanges which are growing stage, which are new entrant into the business. So we are looking for the market makers to cater to the growth of the exchange. We have the OTC volumes, they are very conservative estimates that our OTC market have a volume of around $500 billion per annum. And our current market makers don't have that capacity to cater that kind of volume.
Would the foreign market maker be allowed to trade in Pakistan?
Yes, because generally market, our regulators have a set of rules for the market making. And the entry of you can bring money in the country and you can take your money back with your profits from the country. So it's very convenient for the market makers to bring in the money and take out the money. And even as the regulator allows to cover their position in the one market and to cover their position in another market.
Market making isn't permitted in Indian commodity exchanges, it is permitted on the equity exchanges. But I think we've obviously, it takes a lot longer to build a market if you don't have market makers. But having said that, I think one of the advantages with having to face that struggle is that you have no choice but to address the hedgers. And actually it is easier to get a hedger to take a position on an exchange because he's got the exposure to the commodity. So even if the other side refuses to exit the contract, he can come and deliver. So at least the person who owns the commodity doesn't have a risk. With market making and illiquid contracts, you could get badly hurt in terms of attempting to make a market, especially if you have a position as well, which is what initially you need to do. So. And then, obviously, the market maker expects the exchange to compensate for such losses incurred. So as long as it's market making of the sort of transaction fee waiver, etc., I think it's fine. If it becomes that you pay for beyond that, it can become a very expensive proposition to start markets.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, certainly sentiment that on our exchange we have really two different product sets. We have physical delivery and grain commodities, and then we have a number of classic commodities because we have a licensing agreement with CME, we trade a number of new products. With your traditional grain product that goes to physical delivery, it's very difficult to bring in market numbers. And therefore, we focused our energy on bringing in the hedges. As Vijay said, your risk as a market maker is, you know, you either have to make delivery or take delivery, and this is not your core business. You just want to make a spread on the bid offer. So, we had to focus and build up the relationship with the hedgers. On the CME products, they're obviously very easy. You've got a deep liquid market globally. You just apply financial managers. We've got the balance sheet who want to then just provide the market making on. I guess the moral question is, and interesting to watch how exchanges approach this, is did you pay for that flow? Or do you simply just reduce the fee or not charge the fee to the market maker? Or do you go out there and say, market makers, we're paying you over and above, just go well? So I think just to be clear on the JSE approaches, we do not pay for flow. We will certainly provide a reduced transaction fee to the market maker, but we haven't gone that route to say, yes, a lot of money, please become a market maker.
Well, I'm surprised. I wouldn't expect that a market maker expects him to pay his losses, but because I mean, he's in there to take some risk also to make a market. Lucas,
in our case, we find it also difficult to convince hedgers to come on board and become our market makers. So instead, what we did was we asked our members, broker members, to do market making on our products. There are a number of difficulties they are facing because they are not accustomed to the underlying products that they are doing market making on. So what we did was we make it a bit harder for delivery. So like for instance we make one product that says, the specification of a product, we made it that in such a way that delivery is only possible if you have a multiple of these lots. So this will make our market makers a bit convenient to do market making on our products. Next thing is that we want our market makers also to, our brokers to be accustomed to the underlying product so that they ask whether they are able to, as a company, they are able to trade in that underlying product. Because in our law structure, a broker is a specialized company that has to deal only in broker business. It cannot deal in other business, like for instance, buying and selling commodities. So they have to ask permission from the regulators whether they are allowed to do that. And we need to discuss with our regulators.
Quick, I'm cognizant of the fact that we're running past the 15 hours and 14 minutes limit. But just before I pose a quick question, any burning question out there? No. If that question to the panel, anything you want to get out before we close?
Yeah, certainly look forward to more speculation. So one of the ways in which we expect to do that is India is going to provide entry visas to 180 countries, and so we are hoping a lot more Chinese show
up. Good. Any other one? Okay, on this note, I would like to thank my panel very much for leading this discussion. I invite you to a coffee break now, and all will give you some happiness-related details. Thank you very much.